Welcome to Thoughtcast, also podcast on the web at www.thoughtcast.org. I'm Jenny Atiya. Almost like an organic life form, the internet is evolving. And naturally, we want to know who's in charge and where it's headed. Does it have a life of its own, or is it under our control? Whose internet is it, and what's it doing to us and for us? Can it create its own brave new world, uncensored yet governed by our better instincts? Might it ever become a new kind of home? Here to explore these questions are three internet gurus. All three are influential bloggers and commentators and deeply vested in the purpose and direction of the web. David Weinberger, a philosopher and author who is currently a fellow at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard Law School. Chris Nolan, a former member of the mainstream media who has broken new ground as an independent, self-published, stand-alone journalist, a term she coined. And Stowe Boyd, an entrepreneur, self-described media subversive, and the president of Courant, a company dedicated to promoting social media on the internet. Stowe, let's start with you. As it grows, is the internet mutating in random fashion, or is it guided by intelligent design?
Let me think. I characterized it recently to a friend of mine as kind of the chaotic growth of the internet is kind of like an orgy. I mean, it's not really well planned, but you know, things are happening. You know, stuff's happening. But so it's uncontrolled, but that's good. We don't necessarily want to put controls in place. In fact, that's one of the themes that we seem to this group individually are revisiting time and time again is the questions of controls on the internet and what that means.
The internet is at an interesting point right now. It's shed its baby fat, and it went through a growth spurt, but now it's poised to make a leap. Chris, are we on a threshold with the internet right now? And if so, what does the view look like from there?
Well, I think you're always on a threshold with the net because it's just growing so quickly, and it's going to continue to grow. That's the first thing I'd say. And the second thing is, you know, the idea that this is an adolescent technology is not, I think, one that's going to stand up. This is like a toddler. This is not adolescence.
David?
It's at the very beginning. It's a newborn. It has not yet been absorbed into the institutions that threaten to, well, smother the baby. We don't yet know what's actually going to happen.
And a lot of people are scared, and they think it's annoying. And, you know, I mean, toddlers spend a great deal of time saying, why, and, you know, putting their little fingers in light sockets and generally disrupting everything. So I think this is not, we're nowhere near the end of where we're going to be by any stretch of the imagination.
It seems to me that we are seeing a sort of strengthening of both sides as this titanic clash is really starting to emerge. And it happens in various spots. So right now, it's been happening in the music industry for 5 years or so. It's beginning now to happen in the publishing industry, which is coming to a head now around Google Print, the program of scanning in massive amounts of books. It has yet really to come to a head in government, which pays very little attention to the threat that the internet poses to the worst forms of institutionalization of government. So we have a rolling series of crises, and they're just beginning to be worked out. So right now the internet looks one way. If in the crisis with the publishing industry, it turns out, depending on how that turns out, the internet may look very, very different.
So we may be on a threshold. There is a continuing rolling threshold with the internet, but we're also at a divide still between the offline and the online communities. Where do you see the internet in the near to medium future? What will be the next generation of the internet?
It seems to me that the marketers have now in 2005 just begun to wake up to the internet, which you would have thought 10 years ago, if they'd looked around, they could have seen what was coming. So I'm just seeing in more and more blogs and conferences marketers who are beginning to notice. I'm not talking about marketers who are figuring out how to use the internet. There have been opportunists doing that from the beginning, but marketers who realize that their audience, their markets, have actually the nature of those markets have changed. Now, the nature of those markets changed, started changing 10 years ago. But now the professional marketers are realizing that, for example, we're routing around them, that their customers are not looking to the companies to be the great providers of information, that we're in rebellion, that we actually don't like being marketed to. So it's taken longer than I would have thought for that to seep into the marketers' heads, and I assume it's because it's so counter to how they think about the world, and it's so counter their interests.
Think about the first.
Same thing will happen eventually to politicians, but it may take 20 years.
But think also about the first generation of internet use. And one of the things you saw with the first generation where the big media companies came in is they decided that, oh, it has a screen, we're a TV network, bam, done.
It's
you can put text up there, we're a newspaper, bam, done. And they turned to their marketing and advertising guys and said, oh, it's just the same, we'll just, you know.
Just another channel.
It's just another channel.
Why isn't it just another channel, Chris?
Well, first of all, because people can write, can talk back, and they can do so very effectively.
And they can turn it off.
And they can talk to each other.
They can talk to each other. But the other thing that's happened in the past with this sort of generation of web use is that it's extremely inexpensive to start your own gig. You're a good demonstration of it. What I'm doing at Spot On is a good demonstration. So are these two guys. So, you know, the idea that you have to go to some big corporation and say, hi, I'd like some space on your TV channel / website, why? You don't have to. And that's a whole new experience. And I think it's going to take a very long time for people to sort it out. It's always been there. If you were technically sophisticated, and you knew that the potential was there, but most people weren't. And so this is that wave where people are catching up.
David, this is revolutionary stuff, what Chris is talking about. And you've written about the concept of how the human condition is altering in the face of this force called the web. How do you see the evolution of the web affecting the evolution of people who are now working with it?
I don't think that it's primarily about people becoming small broadcasters, which is a very interesting and important development, but I think is dwarfed by the connective nature of the internet and of the web in particular. I mean, the web is made out of links. Without links, there is literally no web at all. It's just a bunch of pages sitting there. And every time you put a link on your page, you're doing this thing that the commercial sites think is a waste, worse than a waste. You're sending people away.
Yeah, you're saying, you're taking traffic away.
Here's something interesting. Why don't you go over there, away from my site, and look at this other place? You'll be very interested in that. Commercial sites only link to themselves. Everybody else, the people on the internet, have built the web by linking to others, which is a little act of selflessness, it's a little act of generosity, it's a little thing, but it's there, and it's very contrary to the commercial urge. That is fundamentally, I think, an architecture of hope. It's mirroring, it's not even mirroring, it's sort of reinventing what is often considered, and I consider to be the best of humans, which is our connection to other people, our willingness to step back a bit, step down our own egotism, and to say, oh, something else besides me is interesting in the world. But that's exactly what the web is made out of.
So the web is teaching us how to be better people.
I think that it touches what is best in our nature.
Stowe? Is it making you a better person, Stowe?
An impossibility. I have great hopes. I believe that what we're experiencing, that is, those people who have become netizens, you know, who are on there all the time doing stuff, that we are, in fact, countering some social ills, depending on whether or not you believe, these things need to be countered. I think it's a poison that, you know, so many people spend so many hours a day watching television, for example. It's, you know, one of my pet grieves, you know, the thing I gripe about all the time. And, you know, the fact that for whatever reason, whatever thing is tantalizing people to do it, every hour that you spend on the internet is well, more or less an hour that you're not watching television. That's true of the typical person.
It's also an hour you're not outdoors or having coffee with a friend.
Right, but when you're watching television, you're not doing any of those things either.
But is that the choice, the internet or TV?
Well, that is almost the direct correlation.
Yeah, it appears to be the choice that most people are making.
That is the choice that people are making. Instead of passively being entertained with, you know, I don't even want to make comments, but low-grade comedy or drama with soundtracks and voice over
Simpsons?
Tracks and all that stuff. I like The Simpsons, actually. Instead of doing that, people are actually getting online and getting re-engaged with people. And no matter what it is they're up to, whether they're talking about knitting or they're pugs or, you know, running for office, it's better than watching reruns of Perry Mason. There's no doubt about it. And more importantly, and I don't mean this in some sort of moral sense. I mean, it's good for society collectively. I mean, I'm not saying it's good because you're going to ascend to heaven because of it.
I don't understand why you guys all say, I mean, I disagree with both of you. Why is it that you don't think any of this stuff happens without the internet?
What is any of this stuff?
Because if you look
at the
evidence,
you're talking about human interaction.
You know, like you read Bowling Alone, Putnam did all this research showing that people were getting disconnected socially. Recently, we're at an all-time low for, you know, participation in things like the PTA and the Kiwanis Club and so on.
Right.
People don't go to the neighborhood pubs anymore.
Yeah, but they go to the kids' soccer games.
Not, if you look at the hours that people spend doing things like that, it's at an all-time low. But actually, somewhere in Bowling Alone, he suggests that things like the internet might be the only hope. That they're, otherwise, you know, you just try to watch the trend lines going down and they're all going to hit the bottom. I mean, in the absence of something new coming along, his conjecture was that, you know, civic involvement would go to zero.
You're listening to ThoughtCast, also podcast on the web at www.thoughtcast.org. I'm Jenny Attia, and I'm talking with three internet gurus, Stowe Boyd, Chris Nolan, and David Weinberger, about the uses of the internet and its future. The three of you have just completed an intensive symposium here at Harvard, co-hosted by Courant and the Berkman Center, and it was devoted to this concept of social architecture on the internet. Chris, what is social architecture, and how is it possibly going to help some of the issues we've been discussing?
Well, social architecture is anything from Flickr to IMing to blogging to, it's just people yakking it up on the net is what it boils down to. And yeah.
It's the convergence. The notion is that it's the convergence of all of these things that we put the word social in front of. Social
yeah, and,
media.
I mean, don't forget, you're talking about the people
networking.
Who run this thing are engineers. So social is a big thing for them because, well, frankly, not a lot of them get out as much as they should. So that's a large part of what's going on here. So it's got to have a name. So we call it social software or social networking, which is somewhat redundant or so on and so forth. But it's basically what folks are talking about is how people are interacting online.
We should identify what IMing and Flickr are.
Well, there's instant messaging. Flickr is a photo display software, which has come along at the same time that digital cameras have come along. But it's been immensely popular, I think, because you can figure out how to use it. There are things called wikis, which are basically electronic ways of putting up notices and like bulletin boards in a classroom or a college hallway. Blogs are people writing and self-publishing on the web. What else?
There's Friendster.
Yeah, the social networking.
Friendster is Friendster, Orkut, Tribes. I'm losing, there are so many of those, I've lost track.
Do you see
MySpace.
These tools as really making a difference in one's ability to be social? David?
It's something very big is going on. The different types of technology that go into what's called social software, each is a different way in which people connect and communicate, and each has its own shape and thus shapes the relationship. So just to take a really simple example, instant messaging, which everybody's children, as long as you're online, your children are using instant messaging, which is in many ways, very simple technology that allows two people just to chat back and forth, sort of one line, you type and I respond.
Parents hate it.
Part of that is a buddy list, or a list of people that you do IM with, instant message with frequently. this has become, especially in for the younger generation in particular, it's become to older folks like me, instant messaging is an interruption because I'm working on my computer and somebody IMs me. It's like getting a phone call. I have to stop what I'm doing.
Can't not respond, or that would be rude.
Well, but for the younger generation, it's not interruption, it's continuous presence. So my children have long buddy lists that they are going. Now, this is to me the interesting thing. They feel, first of all, this is a set of people who is in some sense that set is always with them and always available, and second of all, that list is going to stay with them for the rest of their lives. So this is a. Why would they give it up? Why would they change it? It's easier to keep somebody on it than to knock them
off. They might start to fight. I mean, I can imagine being very easily dissed by being removed from somebody's list.
Exactly.
Yeah. And they do. Yeah.
So they will carry this with them forever. They will always have all of their friends with them at any time they want, any time of day or night. That's a very different form of sociality than has ever existed before. And I think it's really important. It's not simply I can IM somebody and get an answer to a question. It's the continuous presence of an ever-growing set of friends.
And it's fascinating how it bleeds over into other parts of their lives. I mean, I was actually with, I was doing some research with a client in the Bay Area, you know, yet another company that's doing stuff with music and social, you know, stuff. And it was, but he did this very smart thing where he flew in a couple of teenagers, late teens, and one guy was, I guess, was maybe like 23 or whatever, who are really heavy MySpace users. And we talked to them about what they do with MySpace.
Which is a social networking
and
site.
And when they're on MySpace, which is whenever they're on a computer, they're on there all the time keeping in touch with dozens of people. They're going and looking at people's sites and things that get updated, new music and so on. When they're not in that kind of setting, we were, you know, interrogating them. When they're typically like at home on the phone or whatever, they're on all the time. They don't turn it off.
And you think this is a good thing?
Well, I personally do believe it's a good thing, and I've written a lot about that. But in particular, the other thing that I saw that these two people did, and they were doing it in the room, they kept their phones on. They have a friend that they're on the phone with all the time.
When do they have time for themselves to think?
The friend is on the same service as them, so the minutes don't count, so they never disconnect from their friend.
Where is one's own identity in a world where you're always connected to somebody
else?
Where
it's always been, which is the social identity.
Yeah,
it's always been social. We have a myth of individuals.
You're social, but it's just moving online to a place where you can't see it. And because you can't see it, you don't believe it exists. I mean, these kids are like, I can see it. What's your problem? I know they're there because they're there. See, look, icon.
There's my friend icon?
Yeah.
Well, if I may play
I have a buddy
role.
List, and it comes up every time I turn the machine on, and I go, click, click, click.
Yeah, I believe that the buddy list is becoming the center of the universe for everyone. I believe it is.
You're listening to ThoughtCast, also podcast on the web at www.thoughtcast.org. Chris, I want to ask you, if I can, who do you think is most likely to benefit from these social technologies? Going back, if I may, to your point about certain sorts of technically minded people not being that social offline.
I think when Stowe and David talk about how it's a better social good, I think that's accurate.
For whom?
I think for everybody. I mean, it's more communication and more information. And there's going to be a sort of transition period here where people figure out how to manage all this stuff. We're talking about how people cope with change. We're not saying that change is necessarily, I mean, it's inevitable, but it's not necessarily for the worst.
Well, one change could be that you, for example, might have better or deeper online friendships on occasion than off. Is that at all the case?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think everybody at this table has had that experience.
The relationships are not necessarily better or worse. They're different. Our relationships range from the person who I see every day, whose name I don't know, who gradually I wave at in the real world. Is that a better or worse than, I mean, it's just different. And I have friends, I've made far more friends in the cyber world than I have in the social world. They're friends of a different quality. Often they are friends based around topical interests. So I have friends on a particular topic, somebody who I correspond with through email once every 6 months on some particular topic. I don't have that in the real world.
What are the advantages to you? One of the things, actually, I remember that you've written is that in some ways this technology allows you to manage your time better. And what that makes me think is if the phone is ringing in the old days when there wasn't an answering machine, people answered it. Today, that is just the most intrusive thing to have to answer the phone? I'm wondering, if I may go back to this point, that perhaps people who most benefit from these technologies are people who prefer online relationships. They're perhaps in some way less stressful. They're not face-to-face, obviously. Offline relationships are very anxiety-provoking in many cases. Do you think it's possible that techies have designed this for techies?
You could make the same argument about the telephone. Telephone is a very minimal form of communication. It's disembodied, the sound quality is really crummy. So do people who like talking on the telephone, is that because they are sort of less adept at social relationships and they prefer the thinner, less meaningful ones? I think it's actually, it's almost impossible to compare. And second of all, human beings transcend media all the time.
Perhaps it's just something that people need to get used to.
Or we'll just wait for them to die. That's what Ray Lane claims. He says sometimes you have to wait for a certain generation to die off.
Did he really say that?
Why does it matter to you if other people don't get it or don't care or think it's worthless?
It particularly annoys me, and it's particularly interesting to me when they attempt to step in and take control of it. You know, because they think things are going on there that are questionable, nefarious, there's porn.
People are stealing
music, you know, therefore it's all bad.
Tracking 13-year-old girls.
Let's find a witch and burn one. And
a witch we can't see is always easier to talk to people about because, you know, and nobody else goes online, of course, because it's all filled with witches and porn. So, my gosh, you know.
Yeah, we better step in and regulate it.
Gin up the bonfire.
So most wants to be regulated by people who don't like it, don't understand it, and don't use it.
So you're against regulation, David?
By and large, I am certainly against unnecessary regulation. And the lesson of the internet overall is amazement that complex systems can grow and work without there being any managers involved.
Yeah, and I would say that that's just regulation. A matter of ignorance on the part of the managers. But
the three of you are boosters of the internet. You're passionate about it. But if I may play the curmudgeon for a moment.
Rah, rah.
There are some concerns that get raised about the future of the internet and its impact on us, what it does to us. David Weinberger, you raised a point yourself today that is a concern of yours. You said that the impact of social software, it has the effect of blowing us apart, in quotes, blowing us apart. What were you referring to?
To the internet. The internet has the effect of blowing us to bits, I think is the cliche that I used.
You said social software and the internet in general has right. the effect of blowing us apart.
Yeah, which I think is a good thing. That is, it is a new public space. You don't get those very often. In fact, never a simultaneous one with the real world. It's a new public space that we can do what we want with. We can build the social structures that we want. So the old conventions, the old social norms and hierarchies and relationships in the real world don't exist yet in this world. And that's the sense in which we're blown apart. But I think it's an enormously healthy thing because it gives us a chance to regroup and reorganize in new ways that I hope will get over some of the entrenched old ways of connecting people.
In which ways? Well, like, give me an example.
In a business, there's a hierarchy.
Right.
Email helps to erase that hierarchy.
Okay.
It's easier to email up and down than it is to confront somebody in a public meeting. So it gets over a set of existing. Mm-hmm. Being blown apart is a great thing.
However, you raised it as a concern.
The question is, how are we going to put ourselves together? Are we going to be able to escape from the pull of our old ways of thinking and our old ways of affiliating? My point of view, it would be a bad thing if, and this is not happening, but if it turned out that the blogosphere relationships exactly mirrored the power structure in the world, that the power structure for mass media or for politics or for business.
The opposite of a subversive technology.
Yeah, if it got reinstated so that people who had lots of money got to speak more and louder, that would be a bad thing.
This is Jenny Atiyah, and you're listening to ThoughtCast. I'm joined by David Weinberger of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard, Stowe Boyd, the president of Courant, a web media company, and Chris Nolan, an independent online journalist who writes about the intersection of media and technology. Speaking of making a living, in China, as you know, the government is using internet software sold to China by U.S. companies to monitor the email content of its own people. It's kind of a Big Brother-y sort of thing.
Plus blogs.
What is this potential for abuse here, and what can be done about it?
There's no end of the evil that could be done.
Yeah.
And it's software and hardware being sold to China. And once the capability is put into either, into the hardware, for example, into the routers that move the bits around, as has been done, the potential to listen to the traffic that's going through, it will be an, I believe, irresistible temptation to business and to government to take advantage of it. They will do so in the name of protecting copyright, because we have an insane copyright regime. They will do so in the name of ending spam, and they will do so in the name of security.
Who is they here?
It's each of the industries associated with that and the governments.
All the power structures.
The U.S. government already wants to insist.
So beyond China here. We're going global.
Oh, the technical capability to do this exists, and there's some talk about installing it in the U.S. There's no question.
So what are people like you going to do about that?
We're going to scream.
We're going to scream bloody murder.
At the top of our lungs.
And we won't be heard. We're a very ineffective lobby.
Why is that?
Because the people who care most about it are not, don't have money, are not organized, and don't know how to lobby. We have zero lobbyists on the Hill, just about, arguing on the Capitol, arguing for keeping the internet open. Instead, we have lost the battle over terminology, or metaphor, if you want, so that the very terms of the debate in which ideas are property, we've already lost that battle. And having lost that battle, that would be enough to almost guarantee that we will lose this war.
What you're reminding me, David, of is the way we began this interview. You were expressing some concern about the future of the internet and how it is constantly being attacked. To wrap this up here, can the three of you come up with something really positive to say about where we're heading and what is going to work and you're really excited about and all is well that ends well?
Oh, I go around when I talk to media clients for our writers on our site, I say, hi, we're from the internet. This time we're here to help.
And they believe you?
Let's put it this way. They're not kicking me out the door.
Stowe?
I think that the internet has the possibility of ushering in a number of long overdue changes in our society, global society level. And it's not going to be easy. I think there'll be a lot of stubbed toes and broken fingernails along the way. But I'm overwhelmingly optimistic that the intrinsic sort of democratic capabilities of bottom-up approaches to social interaction will ultimately be reflected in a better world society, not just online, but in the world offline as a whole. And I mean, it could take hours to explain all the reasons why I think that, but I do. And I think it's overwhelmingly positive.
David Weinberger.
Inevitably, the internet is going to connect everybody, rather rapidly, yeah. 10, 20 years. It's going to connect virtually everybody on the planet to every other person and to every piece of information on the planet. And so we're going to face a choice, and in 500 years, our children's children are going to either say, we had the wisdom to usher in an age of enlightenment that so far surpassed the Renaissance that it's not imaginable, or that we voluntarily chose a new dark age.
Oh, but we're supposed to end on a good note.
That is the best I can do.
There is an or in there. Take that as a positive.
Well, exactly. David, Stowe, Chris, thank you so much for joining me.
Our pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you.
You've been listening to Thoughtcast, also podcast on the web at www.thoughtcast.org. To learn more about this trio of internet gurus, go to the site and you'll find links to their blogs as well as some other party favors. This is Jenny Attia. Thanks for joining us.